This is Audible.
The Murder Bag by Tony Parsons. Narrated by Colin Mace. Prologue. 1988. When they had finished with her, they left her face down on the mattress, and it was as if she was already dead. The pack of boys in the basement room, boys with the strength of men and the cruelty of children. They had taken all they wanted, and now it was as if there was nothing left. Their voices were no longer in her face, leering above her, pressed hard against her ear. Now they were coming from the long dining table where they smoked and laughed and congratulated each other on what they had done. There was her T-shirt. If she could only get her T-shirt. Somehow she found the strength to reach it, pull it on, and roll from the mattress. She was not meant to stay in this room. She began to crawl towards the basement stairs. The voices at the table fell silent. The pipe, she thought. The pipe makes them slow and stupid and sleepy. God bless the pipe. There was blood in her mouth, and her face hurt. Everything hurt. The blood was coming from her nose, and it caught in her throat and made her choke back the sickness. She stopped, gagged, then began to move again. The muscles in her legs were heavy slabs of pain. Nothing worked as it should. Nothing felt like it would ever work again. Everything was ruined. She could have wept with frustration, but she bit back the tears and gritted her teeth and kept edging to the door an inch at a time, no more than that, feeling the torn skin on her elbows and knees as she dragged them across the basement floor, doing it again and again and again. There was evil in this room, but she was not meant to die tonight. She was not meant to die in this room. At first, she thought they hadn't noticed, because of what the pipe did to them, because of the way the pipe made them slow and stupid. God bless the pipe. Then she stopped to rest at the foot of the stairs, and she heard their laughter. And when she looked, she saw they were all watching her, and that they had been watching all along. Some of them gave her a round of mocking applause. Then the one who had been the worst, the fat one, who had talked to her all the time and called her names and taken pleasure in hearing her cry out and left his marks on her from tooth and nail, the worst bastard in that bunch of rotten bastards. He yawned widely, revealing a mouthful of expensive orthodontic work, and said, "We can't just let her go, man." She took a deep breath and placed the palms of her hands on the bottom step. There was something wrong with her breathing, because of her nose. A single bead of livid red blood fell onto the back of her hand. She ran her fingers across her top lip and with great effort struggled from her hands and knees onto her feet, leaning against the wall, closing her eyes and longing for sleep. The pain revived her, and the fear, and the presence of the boy. One of them was standing right next to her, a look of wicked amusement on his face, the one who had spoken to her first and stopped her with a smile and pretended to be nice and brought her to this place. Now he took a fistful of her hair and pulled her head to one side, then, tightening his grip as he turned away, he began to drag her from the stairs and back into the room, that underground room where she was not meant to die. Without the prompting of conscious thought, her hands flew to his face, and she pressed her thumbs into his eye sockets as hard as she could, deep and deep and deep. His turn to feel the pain. Rotten bastards. Rotten bastards, the lot of them. The two of them stood there, locked together in the intimacy of dance partners, his fist still in her hair while she summoned all her remaining strength to push into the mocking blue eyes, her fingers with their nails cracked and bloody and suddenly stinging as she scrabbled for purchase in his thick black hair, gripping his ears, losing the grip, finding it again, pushing the thumbs deeper. Then her left hand falling away as he reeled backwards with a rising shriek of agony, lashing out at her and missing. But her right thumb still there, still pushed into his left eye socket as he tried to shove her away, her thumb pressing against his eyeball for a few more crucial seconds until she suddenly felt it give, with a soft, wet squelch, and sink towards the back of his head. He screamed. His scream filled the basement, filled her head, filled the night. They were on their feet at the table, but paralyzed by the screams of the boy who had just lost an eye. Then she ran. How she ran. Flying up the stairs, the door locked from the inside, but with the key mercifully still in the lock. Thank God for the key. Fumbling with it. The cries behind her, and then she was out into the air. Stunned to find the night had almost gone. How long had they kept her there? In the distance was the road. On the far side of playing fields with a misty shroud hanging over the great white H shapes of the rugby posts. She began to run across the playing fields, the fog wet on her face, her bare feet sliding on grass slick with the dawn, and the beautiful buildings of the famous old school rising up black and timeless behind her. She ran without looking back, expecting to hear their voices at any moment, waiting for the pack to come and run her down and rip her to pieces, but they did not come. On the far side of the playing fields, there was a tiny stone cottage, as unlikely as a woodman's house in a fairy tale. But its lights were out, and she made no attempt to run towards it. Instead, she headed for the road. If she could make it to the road, then she would not die tonight. Halfway to the road, she rested against a rugby goalpost and dared to look back. They had not followed her. A leather strap slapped against her side, and she remembered that at some point they had put a dog collar and lead around her neck. She tore them off and threw them aside. A solitary car had stopped by the road, headlights on, engine running. Someone had seen her. She stumbled towards it, waving, calling, crying out for the car to please wait for her. Don't go, don't go. Running alongside a wire mesh fence, looking for a gap, the wet grass of the playing fields no longer under her bare feet. Asphalt now, then through a hole in the fence and running on the road's rough tarmac, crying, oh please, don't go, and then the passenger door opened, and the fat one got out. The one who had been the worst. His face not laughing now, but clenched with absolute murderous fury, and for the first time she knew with total certainty that she would die in this place tonight. More of them were getting out of the car. The fat one flipped open the boot and the black hole waited for her like an open grave. Some part of her mind registered that someone was screaming in the back of the car, screaming about his eye, the one she had hurt, the one she had blinded. She wished she could hurt them all. She wished she could have blinded them all. God knows, they deserved it. But it was too late. She was done now. She felt the weakness and exhaustion flood her body, overwhelming her. They had won. Angry hands on her, touching her, squeezing the last juice out of her, and then the hands lifting her off the ground and forcing her into the boot of the car. The lid slammed down on her, and she was lost in darkness as the car drove slowly back to the grand old school, where she would die on the mattress in the basement, where she was never meant to die. In her last moments, she saw the family who would never see her again, and beyond them, like a road briefly glimpsed but never taken, she saw quite clearly the husband she would never meet, and the children who would never be born, and the good life full of love that had been taken away. And as her soul passed over, her last breath was a silent cry of rage and grief for everything they had stolen on the night she died. October. Hashtag kill all pigs. Chapter 1. I was waiting for a man who was planning to die. I had parked the old BMW X5 just up the road from the entrance to the railway station, and I drank a triple espresso as I watched the commuters rushing off to work. I drank quickly. He would be here soon. I placed three photographs on the dashboard, one of my wife and daughter, the other two of the man who was planning to die. A passport photo from the Home Office and what we called a snatch shot taken from some CCTV footage. I slipped the photo of my family inside my wallet and put the wallet inside my leather jacket. Then I taped the two photos of the man who was planning to die to the dashboard and I watched the street. I was parked with my back to the station so I could face the busy main road. It was washed in thin autumn sunshine that was like a fading memory of summer days. 100 metres away there was a young woman who was dressed for the gym, looking in the window of the newsagents, a large German shepherd sitting patiently by her side, its lead loose, its intelligent face carefully watching her, the dog totally at ease among the rush hour crowds. "Now that's a beautiful dog," I said. The woman smiled and scratched the back of the dog's ears in response, and then there was a man's voice in my ear, although he was not addressing me. "Reception's good for Delta One." Then there were more voices in my ear as they checked transmission for the other radio call signs, and all over the surveillance chatter I could hear the studied calm that the police use at moments of extreme tension. Like a pilot talking to his passengers when all his engines are on fire. "Nothing at all to worry about, folks." I scanned the street for the spotter vans and unmarked cars and plainclothes officers on foot, but they were good at their job. All I could see was the woman with the beautiful German shepherd. "Delta One," the surveillance officer said to me, "we see you and we hear you, Max. You're running point. We're waiting on your positive visual ID when Bravo One is in the grab zone. Stay in the car." Bravo One was the man who was planning to die. "Copy that," I said. And then a voice I knew. "DC Wolf, it's the Chief Super. Detective Chief Superintendent Elizabeth Swire, my boss." "Ma'am," I said. "Good luck, Wolf," she said. Then there was a little smile in her voice as she played to the gallery. "And you heard the man. Stay in the car. Let the big boys do the heavy lifting." I stared at the street. It would not be long now. "Ma'am," I said, as nice and calm as the German shepherd. If I tilted my rearview mirror, I could look up at the grand Victorian facade of the station hotel. It was like a castle in a fairy story, the turrets and spires rising up to a blue sky full of billowy white clouds. The kind of place where you blink your eye and 100 years go by. I could not see any of the big boys, but inside the railway station hotel, there were enough of them to start a small war. Somewhere beyond the net curtains and drapes, SCO-19 were waiting, the firearms unit of the Metropolitan Police. Every one of them would be armed with a Heckler & Koch G-36 assault rifle and two Glock SLP 9mm pistols. But no matter how hard I stared, I still couldn't see them. There would also be bomb disposal squads, seconded from the RAF in there, negotiators, chemical and biological warfare specialists, and someone to order pizza. We also had maybe 20 people around the station, but I could still only see the woman and the dog. The surveillance chatter continued. "All units report. Echo One. No sign. Victor One. Nothing. Tango One. Contact," said a woman's voice. For the first time, the piece of plastic stuffed in my ear was totally silent. "I have visual with Bravo One," said the same voice. "Contact." And then a terrible pause. "Possible," she said. "Repeat. Possible contact." "Possible," the surveillance officer said. "Checking. Stand by." His voice was winding tighter now. And then the woman's voice again, and all the doubt creeping in. "Possible. Red backpack, just passing the British Library, proceeding on foot in an easterly direction towards the station, approaching the grab zone." "Delta One?" "Copy that," I said. "And I'm off," Tango One said, meaning she had lost visual contact with the target. I glanced quickly at the two photographs taped to my dashboard. I didn't really need to, because I knew exactly what he looked like. But I looked one last time anyway. Then, back at the crowds. "I don't see him," I said. Then a more urgent voice in my ear. Another woman, the officer with the dog. It watched her intently as her mouth moved.
This is Whiskey One. Whiskey One, I have possible visual contact. Bravo One coming now, 200 metres. Far side of the road, easterly direction. Red backpack, possible contact.
A babble of voices and a sharp call for silence.
Possible. Checking, checking. Stand by all units. Stand by Delta One.
Then there was just a silence, crackling with static. Waiting for me now. At first, I stared straight through him, because he was different. I looked quickly at the two photographs on the dashboard, and he was nothing like them. The black hair was light brown. The wispy beard had gone. But it was far more than that. His face had changed. It was filled out, puffed up, almost the face of someone else. But one thing was the same.
Delta One.
Contact, I said. The red backpack was exactly the same as the one in the CCTV snapshot on the day he brought hydrogen peroxide in a chemist's wholesale warehouse. He was wearing that red backpack when he wheeled out the 440 litres of hair bleach to the cash desk, wearing it when he counted out the £550 in £50 notes, wearing it when he unloaded his van at the lock-up garage where we had put our cameras. You couldn't miss that red backpack. It looked like the kind of bag you would use to climb Everest, big and bright. Safety red, they called that colour. But his face was not the same. That threw me. It was meant to. The face had been pumped full of something. He was planning to go to his death with the face of another man. But I could see it now. There was no doubt.
That's him, I said. Contact. He's had something done. I don't know, some work to his face, but that's him. Contact. Confirming visual identification. Contact.
Sniper One in range, said a voice, and across the street I saw the shooters for the first time.
Three figures moving on the rooftops above a shabby strip of shops and restaurants, their weapons winking in the sunlight. Police, marksmen, settling into position. Our last resort, if it all went wrong. And it was already starting to go wrong.
Sniper Two in range, but I don't have a trigger, no clear shot. It's crowded down there.
The man with the red backpack had paused on the far side of the road, waiting for the lights to change. Traffic thundered by, and in the gaps there were flashes of safety red. I touched my earpiece. Suddenly, nobody was talking to me anymore.
That's our boy, I said. Positive ID. Contact. Contact. Over.
The lights changed, and the traffic reluctantly stopped. The commuters began to shuffle across the road. The man with the red backpack went with them. I spoke slowly and clearly.
This is Delta One confirming contact. The target is about to enter the grab zone. Do you copy me? Over.
And nothing but the white noise in response. And then,
possible, checking, stand by.
I shook my head and was about to speak again when the calm voice of DCS Swire said,
it's a negative, Wolf. That's not him. Negative. Cancel.
And then the voice of the surveillance officer.
Negative, cancel, stand down all stations.
The lights changed again. The man with the red backpack had crossed the road. He was heading for the railway station.
Do you expect him to wear a burqa? I said. That's Bravo One, that's the target, that's our boy, his face.
We do not have visual confirmation, the surveillance officer said. We do not have positive ID, Delta One.
And then Swire. That's not him, she repeated. Stop talking, Wolf. A note of steel now. You had one task. It is concluded. No further action necessary. We're standing down all units. Negative. Cancel. Thank you, everyone.
The crowd slowed outside the station as it merged with the flow of commuters coming over from King's Cross.
I figured that I had 1 minute to stop him before he disappeared inside the station.
Once on a mainline train or down on the tube or on the concourse of the station itself, the man with the red backpack would simply touch his hands together and the world would blow apart. The battery, he probably already held in one hand, would create an electric current connecting it to a simple terminal held in the other. The current would then pass down two wires and into that red backpack. A discreet slit would have been cut in the side, where a modified light bulb would trip a detonator stored inside a small tube. This would trigger the main charge, the hydrogen peroxide I had watched him buy with 11 £50 notes on CCTV. At the same time, he had bought a bulky supply of 6-inch steel nails, sacks of them. They would be taped to the outside of the main charge to inflict enough misery to last for several hundred lifetimes. If it detonated. If he was that smart. If he hadn't messed up the cook. I choked down a lump of hot, bitter nausea as it rose in my throat. "You're wrong," I said. "That's him. Contact." I'd been inside his lockup. I had seen the hundreds of empty bottles of hair bleach. I had watched the CCTV footage of the day he bought them until my eyes were burning with the sight of him. I didn't need the photographs taped to the dash. I knew him. He was in my head. He could not hide from me.
"Stand down, all units," a self-consciously calm voice was saying. "Do you copy me, Delta One?"
"No," I said. "You're breaking up." 30 seconds now. And among all those crowds, and surrounded by all those firearms, I was on my own with a man who was planning to die. I once attended a lecture at the police academy in Bramshill, Hampshire, the Oxford and Cambridge of police higher education. An FBI agent had been flown over to help us combat terrorism. I had been impressed by the whiteness of the agent's teeth. They were a fine set of teeth, very American teeth. But what impressed me more was that the man knew his business. His teeth shining, he told us that the FBI had identified 25 threat areas for terrorist activity. It wasn't quite an A to Z, but it was close. It was an A to T, from airports to tattoo parlours, everywhere basically. The Fed also suggested what possible terrorists might look like. Everyone, basically. The students at Bramshill, the brightest and the best, all these fast-tracked cops, the next generation of CID, young and tough and smart, had almost wet themselves with laughter. But unlike the rest of them, I did not find the talk useless. Just the opposite, because I remembered the FBI man's number one point of potential indicators. The suspect significantly alters his appearance. Although my colleagues had smirked and rolled their eyes, I thought that was a point well worth making. Never overlook the obvious. Don't expect him to look like the photographs and the CCTV images. Be ready for him to look like someone else. And here was another thing the FBI agent could have mentioned. The target, who significantly alters his appearance, will probably not bother to get a new bag. "The same backpack," I said, opening the car door. "In the CCTV, red backpack. When he bought the gear, red backpack, all the way through. That's the red backpack, and that's him." "You can't park here, mid," an Afro-Cockney voice said through my window, and I jumped to hear a voice that did not come from somewhere inside my head. A traffic warden was writing me a parking ticket. I got out of the car. He was a tall man with West African tribal scars on his cheeks, and he reared back slightly, expecting trouble. I looked past him and could see the man with the red backpack. The crowds had thinned now. He was about to enter the station. 15 seconds. Then a voice inside my head. "This is DCS Swire. Get back in the bloody car, Wolf." All pretense at calm now gone, I hesitated for a moment. Then I got back into the car. The traffic warden was tucking a ticket under my windscreen wiper. I shook my head and looked in the rearview mirror. The man with the red backpack was directly behind me now, standing right outside the main entrance to the station. The crowds were melting away. There was nothing stopping him entering. But he had paused directly outside the station. He was talking to himself. No. He was praying. 10 seconds. The man with the red backpack moved forward. 9 seconds. I stuck the car into reverse. 8 seconds. I twisted in my seat and slammed my foot to the ground. The car shot backwards, and I stared at the man with the red backpack as I hurtled towards him. I had one arm braced across the passenger seat for the shock of impact, and the hand on the wheel pressed down hard on the horn, keeping it there, scattering the stray commuters. He did not move. But he looked into my eyes as the old X5 shot towards him, his mouth no longer praying. 5 seconds. The car ploughed into him, striking him just above the kneecaps, shattering the thigh bones of both legs as it whipped his torso forward against the back of the car. His face shattered the rear window, and the rear window did the same to his face. Then the impact threw him backwards into a wall of red Victorian brick, where the back of his head erupted like a soft-boiled egg being hit with a sledgehammer. 3 seconds. I stuck the car in drive and tore back across the forecourt to where the traffic warden was staring at me, motionless, open-mouthed, his ticket machine still in his hand. I put the car into reverse, ready to go again, but there was no need to go again. Zero. I slowly got out of the car. People were screaming. Some of them were commuters. Some of them were the voices in my head. A dog, getting closer every second, was barking wildly. One voice in my ear was shouting about gross misconduct and manslaughter. Another was shouting about murder. Wolf! Swire. I tore out the earpiece and threw it away. The man with the red backpack was sitting up against the brick wall, staring straight at me with a baffled expression on his ruined face. One hand still twitched with the surprise of sudden death. Both of his hands were empty. I was not expecting his hands to be empty. Suddenly, there were armed men in balaclavas. Guns were trained on the dead man. Glock SLP 9mm pistols. Heckler and Koch submachine guns. Then I saw that some of them were pointing at me. "He was the target," I said. Armed officers from SCO 19 were everywhere. Commuters were running and crawling for cover. A lot of people were screaming and crying because these men with guns did not look remotely like police officers. They wore Kevlar body armour. They had metal carabiners on their shoulders so they could more easily be dragged away if they were down. The black balaclavas they wore had the eyes and mouths cut out. They looked like paramilitary bank robbers. People thought it was to protect their identity, but I knew it was to spread terror, and it worked. They were shouting into the radios attached just above their hearts. The masked faces were bawling at me to get down and stay down and lie on my face. "Now, now, now, do it now!" Slowly I took my warrant card out of my jeans, showed it, and tossed it at them. Then I held up my hands, but I wasn't getting on my knees for them. I wasn't getting down on my face. I kept walking towards the man on the ground, because I had to know if I was right. "Last chance! Do it now!" Crouching above the dead man on the ground, I saw that the impact had not cracked the back of his skull. It had removed it. A huge slick of fresh blood was already spreading across the pavement. All around, there were the screams of terror and fury. The dog was so close now that I could smell it, so close now that I could feel its breath. I could see the strange, flat-nosed Glocks in the corner of my vision, aimed at the dead man on the ground and also at my face. The safety catches were released. But this was our boy, wasn't it? I looked at my hands with wonder. They were covered in the dead man's blood. But they were not shaking as I tore open the red backpack and looked inside. Chapter 2. "Sorry," I said, my body clenched tight inside the suit I had not worn since my wedding day. The office was crowded with the full cast of a murder investigation. A socko was standing directly in front of me, trying to get past, all in white apart from the blue face mask that covered everything but the irritation in her eyes. I was in a big corner room near the top of a shining glass tower, but I flashed briefly on the many school playgrounds of my childhood, and how you can feel both invisible and in the way just because you were new. And then there was a spark of recognition in the socko's eyes. "I know you," she said. "I'm the new man," I said. "No," she said, "you're the hero at the railway station." "When did you start working homicide?" "Today." Now she was smiling behind her blue face mask. "Cool. What did they call you in court?" "Officer A." "You kill anybody this week, Officer A?" "Not yet," I said, "but it's only Monday morning." She laughed and left me standing by the dead man's desk. There wasn't much on it, just fresh blood and an old photograph. In the photograph, 7 young men in military uniform smiled for the camera, as if they were looking at their unbreakable future. Blood had splattered across one corner of the glass, but it did nothing to hide their cocky faces. It was a strange photograph to have on an office desk. No wife, no kids, no dog. Just seven young soldiers, defaced now with a bright spurt of blood. Travel blood. Fresh from an artery. I looked closer and saw the photograph was taken in the 80s, judging by the washed-out colours and the mullet haircuts of the cocky lads. Their hair was from another decade, and their uniforms were from another century. They looked like Duran Duran at Waterloo. And I saw that they were not men. These were boys, who would be boys for perhaps one more summer. And despite the military uniforms, they were not real soldiers, just students dressed as soldiers. Two of them looked like twins. One of them was the dead man on the far side of the desk. He had grown up to be a banker. He had grown up to be murdered. I stood aside as a forensic photographer started taking pictures of the desk's bloody mess. "Who would want to kill a banker?" the photographer said. It got a laugh, mostly among the soccos, chuckling away behind their face masks. Spend your life collecting microscopic samples of blood, semen and dirt, and you are grateful for any laugh you can get. But the senior detective standing on the far side of the desk did not smile, although I could not tell if he had heard the remark, or if he was preoccupied with the corpse before him, or if he disapproved of levity in the presence of death. He was waiting patiently, while a small man with a briefcase, the divisional surgeon, here to pronounce death, knelt over the body. The detective's large head was shaved so clean it shined, and despite his extravagantly broken nose, and it had been broken so often it looked like a wonky ski run, he had enough vanity to keep his pale, goatee beard neatly trimmed. He turned his piercing blue eyes on me, and I thought that he looked like a Viking. I could imagine that pale, fierce face coming up the beach for a spot of pillaging and monk bothering. But Vikings didn't wear glasses, and the detectives were round and rimless. John Lennon imagined specs. They softened his ferocious appearance and gave his hard face a kindly, slightly perplexed expression. My new boss. "DC Wolf, sir," I said. "Ah, our new man," he said, the quiet voice precise and clipped with the vowels of the distant north, Aberdeen or beyond, the kind of Highlands accent that sounds as if every word is carved from granite. "I'm DCI Mallory." I already knew his name. I had never met him before, but I had heard of him enough. Detective Chief Inspector Victor Mallory was one of the reasons I wanted the transfer to Homicide and Serious Crime Command. We were both wearing thin blue gloves and made no attempt to reach across the desk and shake hands, but we smiled and took a second to size each other up. DCI Mallory looked very fit, not just for a man in his early 50s, but for a man of any age, and it looked like the kind of fitness that comes from natural athleticism rather than hours in the gym. He watched me with his blue eyes as the divisional surgeon fussed briskly over the corpse. "You're just in time," Mallory said. "We're about to begin. Welcome to Homicide." Friendly, but skipping all small talk. The divisional surgeon was standing up. "He's dead, all right," he said, snapping his bag shut. Mallory thanked him and gave me the nod. I stepped forward. "Come and have a look at our body, Wolf," he said, "and tell me if you've ever seen anything like it." I joined DCI Mallory on the far side of the desk, and we stood above the dead man. At first, all I saw was the blood, lavish arterial sprays, with a man in a shirt and tie somewhere beneath it all. "The deceased is Hugo Buck," Mallory said, 35 years old, investment banker with China Corps. Body discovered by cleaning staff at 6 a.m. He gets in early. Works with the Asian markets. While he was having his first coffee, somebody cut his throat. Mallory looked at me keenly. "Ever seen one of these?" I did not know how to respond. The banker's throat had been more than cut. It had been ripped wide open. The front half of his neck was cleaved away, sliced out with clean precision. He was flat on his back, but it felt like only a bit of bony gristle was keeping his head attached to his body. The blood had erupted from his neck in great spurts. His shirt and tie looked like some monstrous red bib. I could smell it now, the copper stink of freshly spilt blood. I shut my mind to it. Hugo Buck's jacket was still on the back of his chair. Somehow, the fountains of blood had not touched it. I looked quickly at Mallory, and then back at the dead man. "I've seen three cutthroats, sir," I said. I hesitated, and he nodded once, telling me to carry on. First week in uniform, there was a husband who saw a text message on his wife's phone from his best friend and reached for a carving knife. Maybe a year later, I attended a robbery in a jewellery shop where a gun failed to discharge and the thief produced an axe and went for the man who pushed the security button. And then there was a wedding reception where the father of the bride objected to the best man's speech and shoved a champagne flute into his neck. Three cutthroats. Did any of them look anything like this?
No, sir.
This is almost a decapitation, Mallory said. I looked around. Somebody must have heard something, I said.
Nobody heard a thing, Mallory said.
There are people around in a building like this even at that time of day, but nobody hears a thing when a man almost gets his head chopped off. He considered me with his pale blue eyes, but I didn't get it.
Because the victim's windpipe was cut, he said. The trachea. There was no air, and you need air to scream. Nobody heard anything because there was nothing to hear.
We contemplated the body in silence, while all over the large office the SOCOs moved in slow motion, like scientists examining the aftermath of a biological catastrophe. They were identical, in their masks and gloves and white suits, patiently hunting for prints, placing tiny fibres in evidence bags and taking samples of blood from a desk, the carpet and the glass walls. There was a lot of blood to choose from. One SOCO was drawing a sketch. The photographer, who had wondered why anyone would want to kill a banker, had stopped taking stills and was now filming the room. Small, numbered, yellow plastic markers were blooming all over the lush carpet as SOCOs harvested footprints for forensics to match against SICAR, the Shoe Print Image Capture and Retrieval Database. Mallory watched them.
Most professional hits are very amateur, Wolf. Is that an irony or a paradox? They're carried out by thugs hired in the pub, morons who will kill anyone for some cash in hand. Most professional hits come with a guarantee. They guarantee to do it badly, but not this one. You see how clean that cut is. Most people, cutting someone's throat, they slash and chop and saw. They make a mess, don't they? You saw that with your three. About as big a mess as an enraged human being can make to flesh and blood with something sharp. But this looks like just one cut. It almost took his head off, but it's just one cut. Now who cuts a throat like that?
Someone who knew what they were doing. I thought about it.
A butcher? A surgeon? A soldier? You think we've got Rambo running around out there?
I don't know if he's running around, sir. Maybe he's sleeping on the streets. Mallory nodded beyond the glass walls to the city 30 floors below, spangled with autumn sunshine around the old grey serpent of a river.
How many ex-servicemen are sleeping on those streets? He asked.
Too many, I said. I tried to imagine it. He comes in here during the night to find somewhere warm to sleep, to find something worth stealing. Gets disturbed. I couldn't make it work. But he has to get past security.
Butcher, surgeon, soldier, Mallory said. Or perhaps it was someone who had no idea what they were doing. One of Mr. Buck's fellow bankers, one of the cleaning staff. Perhaps it was just beginner's luck. Or perhaps it was his wife. Apparently she didn't like him much.
Officers were called out to a domestic dispute between Mr. and Mrs. Buck 3 nights ago. There was some violence.
Did you see the marital bed?
A mattress was leaning against one of the glass walls, a king-sized bed still wrapped in courier's cellophane and bearing the purple and orange FedEx markings.
"That's their bed," I said. "His wife sent their bed to his office."
Mrs. Buck returned home early from a business trip and discovered Mr. Buck with the housekeeper. Mallory frowned with embarrassed disapproval, and he wasn't helping her to unload the dishwasher. So Mrs. Buck went for Mr. Buck with an oyster knife.
An oyster knife?
Yes, an oyster knife. It has a short, broad blade. These are affluent people. They like oysters.
Anyway, she threatened to cut his testicles off and shove them up his back passage.
Responding to sounds of a violent struggle, the neighbours call 999. Officers restrain both of them. Mr. Buck hasn't slept at home since.
We looked at the marital bed in its FedEx wrapping.
"You think the wife did this, sir?" I said.
Mallory shrugged. "Right now she's all we've got. She's on record as making a threat to remove her husband's testicles."
He looked down at the banker's mutilated throat.
"Although nobody's aim is that bad."
"She may have delegated," I said. "She has the money to hire someone good."
"That was my thought," Mallory agreed.
"But then there would be glove prints.
And we can't find any glove prints. And unless she hired someone who didn't have any idea what they were doing, there should certainly be glove prints in this room.
As you know, glove prints can be as distinctive as fingerprints. If the gloves are thin enough, fingerprints can pass through the material. Fingerprints can also be present inside the gloves. Few villains take their gloves home, preferring to ditch them close to the crime scene. So we're looking for a pair of gloves as well as glove prints."
"And what happens if we can't find glove prints?"
"Then we have to eliminate every print in the room." I looked again at the photograph on the desk, and I could see it now. The boy, the man had been. Hugo Buck was standing on the far right of the photograph, and one tiny spot from the spray of blood had flecked his image. 20 years had gone by, but the smooth, good looks of the future banker were there, buried under a shallow layer of puppy fat. The boys become the men, I thought, and the living become the dead.
"Did you see his hands?" Mallory said.
Buck's hands had fallen by his side, but still gripped the vial of pills he had been holding in the last moment of his life. It was another thing I was seeing for the first time.
"Cadaveric spasm," Mallory said, smiling now, perhaps happy to show me that I hadn't seen everything yet, that I hadn't seen anything yet.
"Instant rigor, caused by shock of sudden death, locking the body in its final second of life. That Pompeii moment."
"Can you make the pills out?"
I crouched by the corpse and peered at the label, trying to shut out the copper stink of his blood.
"Zestiretic," I read. "Take one daily as directed. Prescription only. Made out to Mr. Hugo Randolph Buck."
"Zestiretic?"
"For hypertension," Mallory replied. "Blood pressure pills."
"He was a bit young to be taking blood pressure pills, wasn't he?" I said, standing up.
"Must be a lot of stress working in banking."
"And more stress at home," Mallory added. We stared at the dead man in silence.
"Why didn't they just shoot him?"
Mallory asked suddenly.
I looked at him.
"The banker?"
"The bomber," Mallory said. "Your bomber. The chief super panics. The surveillance officer freezes. Nobody's sure if it's the man they want. I understand all of that. Nobody wants Jean-Charles Domenez on their CV. Everyone's jumpy because any fatal shooting has to go before an IPCC inquiry now. You've got the Crown Prosecution Service waiting in the wings, the human rights lawyers."
Mallory smiled shyly, blue eyes twinkling.
"But you confirmed a positive ID. You overruled the surveillance officer. It was your call. You had seen the man, watched him, followed him, studied him. It was your career on the line, your liberty. Why didn't they shoot him?
They can only shoot him in the head, sir, I said. New rules of engagement. Everything else is too risky. Can't shoot him in the torso because he could be wearing a vest. Can't shoot him in the arms or legs because then he still has a chance to detonate whatever he's carrying. I shrugged. Maybe they didn't feel confident they could get a clean headshot. Maybe they believed the SO and the Chief Super and not me. All I can say is there was a genuine element of doubt, and maybe shooting a man in the head when there was an element of doubt seemed rash. Mallory nodded. And maybe we're becoming afraid to do our job. How do you like this for a robbery? This wasn't a robbery, I said. The Rolex on Mr. Buck's wrist has to be worth 15 grand. Unless it was a robbery that was disturbed, Mallory said. I looked beyond the banker's door to the vast open-plan office. This place must take some cleaning, I said. All authorized personnel, Mallory said. You can't take a leak in this building without a laminated card and photo ID. We're waiting for a translator so we can interview the cleaner who found Mr. Buck. He's fresh from Vilnius. I thought everyone spoke English now. He can't speak it today, just Lithuanian. Finding the body shook him up. The rest of the cleaning staff are down in the underground car park. We can't let them go until we've had a word. My two DIs are down there. Detective Inspector Gain and Detective Inspector Whitestone. If you can give them a hand. Yes, sir, I said. At the door of the banker's office, two uniformed officers had established an entry and exit corridor where they logged everyone who came and went from the crime scene. Two PCs, one male and one female, both young, both of them with dark red hair. They could have been brother and sister, despite the fact that the woman was small and whippet thin, and the man tall and gangly. From the state of them, they had to be the officers who had answered the call. The man, a boy, I thought, although he was in his mid-twenties and only a few years younger than me, looked on the verge of passing out. As I approached, he leaned against the wall and choked back the urge to be sick. The woman, and she looked like a girl despite the Metropolitan Police uniform, placed one small hand on her colleague's shoulder. She looked up at me as I signed out of the crime scene.
His first body, sir,
she explained, almost apologetic. She hesitated for a moment.
Mine too.
She was dealing with it better than the boy, but both of their startled faces were wide open and frozen with shock. Like children who had just come downstairs and found their pet dead in its cage, or seen through Santa's disguise and got their first real glimpse of this wicked world. Breathe, I told him. I inhaled deeply through my nose, released it through my mouth with a controlled sigh, showing him how to do it.
Sir,
he said. There were six lifts for the office workers and one much larger and much dirtier for the help. I took the stairs, thinking I might find gloves. 30 flights. By the time I was halfway down, I was starting to sweat, but my breathing was still even. I stopped at a sound in the stairwell, 100 metres below. Looking down, I glimpsed a blur of movement. There was the hint of a shadow, and then a distant door slammed shut. I called out, but there was no response, and I took the final flights more slowly, stopping when I saw something written on the wall. One word in black. The shade of black that blood dries to. Pig. Not taking my eyes from the three letters, I took out my phone and photographed the black word on the filthy wall. Then I went down the rest of the stairs, hearing a babble of voices now rising up from below ground, the sound getting louder every second. On the basement floor, I shoved open the door and looked out an underground car park that was full of cleaning staff. They had been invisible from the street. Men and women, young and old, talking in 20 different languages. The unseen people who came every day to clean the floors and the windows and the toilets in the shining glass tower. And I saw that they were beyond number. The armies of the poor. Chapter 3. When I arrived home that night, I knew something was wrong, even before I got through the front door. We lived in a big top-floor loft, and the stench filled every corner of it. I knew immediately where the stink came from because the clues were everywhere. A single shoe in the hallway studded with teeth marks, wooden floorboards that had been scrubbed clean to conceal evidence, a rubbish bin stuffed with stained kitchen roll, and everywhere there was that smell, meaty and musty and peaty, the smell of animal. The dog had been bad again. On the far side of the loft, an elderly woman with white hair was sitting at one end of a sofa, with a little red dog on her lap. At the other end of the sofa was a fresh, wet stain that would now be there forever. Mrs. Murphy was watching TV with the sound turned off, which was always her custom when my daughter, Scout, was sleeping. Without moving his tennis ball-sized head from his front paws, the red dog, Stan was his name, rolled his huge round eyes up to look at me. You could see the whites of his bulging eyes around the blackness, as though the sockets were too small to contain such a pair of headlamps. He caught my eye and quickly looked away. "Mrs. Murphy," I said, "you've had so much work again." "Don't worry none," she said, scratching the dog behind his ears, her soft accent sounding as if she had never left County Cork a lifetime ago. "Stand still, little, and the good news is that Scout ate her dinner, some of it anyway. She doesn't eat much, does she? There's nothing of her." I nodded and went off to look in on my daughter. Scout was 5 years old and still slept in the baby fashion, with her hands held up in loose fists by the side of her head, like a tiny weightlifter. The light was on in her room, although she must have been sleeping for hours. She had slept with the light on ever since we lost her mother. I picked up a school sweater from the floor, folded it and placed it on the back of a chair where Mrs. Murphy had tomorrow's school uniform more neatly folded and waiting. I hesitated, wanting to turn off her light. She couldn't keep it on forever. But in the end, I didn't have the nerve. Mrs. Murphy was putting on her coat. "It will get better," she told me. I woke before dawn. I always woke before dawn. In the dreaming period of sleep, the lightest phase of sleep, REM sleep, I surfaced, waking on my side of the double bed, the left side, chased from my rest by yesterday's coffee and my dreams of the dead. I was always right there, waiting for the day before the day ever had a chance to begin. Turning off my alarm before it had the chance to ring, I slipped out of bed without making a sound. I brushed my teeth and went back into the bedroom, got down on my hands and knees and quickly pumped out 25 press-ups. Then I sipped the water by my bedside, looking out of the window at the October sky, 6 in the morning and still black over the nearby dome of St. Paul's Cathedral. I got down and did 25 more press-ups, slower and more deliberate this time, thinking about technique. I gave myself a minute's break, then did 25 more, starting to feel it now, my arms shaking with the build-up of lactic acid in the muscles. I stayed on the ground, found my breath, and forced out the final 25. An act of will, not strength. I padded quietly to the kitchen, anxious not to wake daughter or dog. But hearing Stan breathing in the dark, a snorting, snuffling sound coming out of a nose that did not really resemble anything up to the difficult task of breathing, I stood there, listening to him, enjoying the sound. He was wiped out after another busy night destroying our home. Then he stirred at my presence, the large ears falling across his face like silky curtains, the soulful eyes blinking open and glittering behind his lavish ears. And then he was awake too, staring at me through the bars of his cage, hopeful of an early release. I got him out, held him against my chest. Stan pressing a nose like a squashed prune against my fingers, sniffing them with interest. Stan had been with us for a month. It felt much longer. My present to Scout on her 5th birthday. I'd found the breeder online, collected Stan on the day he turned 8 weeks old, and carried him into the loft with a blanket over his head like a guilty man heading for the High Court. Every time I thought I'd made a mistake, that the dog was my pitiful attempt to give Scout a proper family life, I remembered the first time she had seen Stan. Her smile was like the sun coming up. That's how I knew the dog was not a mistake.
In the kitchen, I drank a triple espresso with him on my lap. The only light coming from my laptop as I searched medical sites for information on how to cut a windpipe. Stan went back to sleep as I learned that either side of the windpipe are the carotid arteries, bringing blood from the heart to the brain, and that severing them is one of the most fatal head injuries known to man. But no matter how many surgical websites I looked at, and no matter how many times I typed cut throat into the search engine, I could find no weapon that looked remotely capable of doing the job. In the end, the search engine gave up on me, directing me to shaving websites where they sold foam, balm, gel, and a variety of old-fashioned straight razors. They were interesting-looking blades, vicious enough to put a smile on Sweeney Todd's face, but I couldn't see how any of them could have cut deep enough to remove most of Hugo Buck's throat. At 7, the sky finally started to lighten. I snapped shut the laptop as Scout appeared, padding into the kitchen still in her pyjamas and puffy with sleep. Stan struggled down from my lap and flew at her. Our loft was huge, far too big for a man, child and dog. Our family had grown smaller, while the loft seemed to get bigger. Now we rattled around in all that empty space, under the exposed wooden beams and brickwork, the dog's paws skidding on the polished wooden floorboards as he chased towards Scout, sniffing and licking and nuzzling, clambering up her leg, crazy with love.
"Stan was bad," she said,
absent-mindedly scratching the top of his small head.
"I know."
"On the sofa."
"I saw."
"And in the kitchen. And by the door."
She thought about it.
"Everywhere, really."
"Mrs. Murphy took care of it."
"I helped her."
"Thank you for that."
A pause.
"Do we have to give him back?" she said.
I squatted down to be level with her head. Her light brown hair, her dark brown eyes, the sweeping curve of her face. They all came straight from her mother. Even her name was from a character in a book that my wife loved. My wife was gone, but every time I looked at my daughter, I saw her face.
"This is our dog," I said, and found myself quoting Mrs. Murphy. "It will all get better, okay?"
"Okay."
We slipped into our breakfast routine. Toast for Scout, porridge for me. Nature's menu dog food for Stan. After carrying her plate to the sink, Scout went off to brush her teeth. That had been one of her mother's rules. Teeth are brushed after the meal, not before. And we really did our best to stick to her rules. We lived opposite the great old meat market of Smithfield. At this time of the morning, the men were ending their long night shift. The butchers and porters were finishing the last of their loading and making their way to cafes and pubs that had opened long before dawn. A few were already outside the early morning pubs with pints of lager in their red fists, big men wilting in the daylight and blurry with exhaustion, white aprons smeared with blood and gore. As we walked through their world, some called out a greeting to Stan, and Scout and I smiled with pride. He was a striking dog. In the pale daylight, you could see the beauty of his colour, a rich chestnut somewhere between rusty red and old gold. His fur was wavy, and on the tips of those oversized ears, there were ringlets of extravagant curls, as though he'd spent the previous evening with a fancy hairdresser rather than urinating on our furniture. Held in check by Scout, who had his leather lead wrapped twice around the wrist of her right hand, Stan trotted happily by her side, his small head up and alert, his tail stiff with anticipation, and then whipping like a windscreen wiper in a thunderstorm when something caught his eye. And Stan was amazed by everything. He stared with awe at a porter across the street having a cigarette outside the market. A jogger went by and Stan stood stock still, his head tilted to one side as if witnessing an alien landing. Scout and I laughed. Most of our laughs came from the dog. He looked at a piece of chewing gum, or a discarded cup, or a shard of broken glass, and instantly lurched towards it, dragging Scout with him. The sun was up now, and making me squint. Fresh autumn light can be more crystal clear than summer's haze. I felt the rawness of the day and the bad sleeper's burden, the knowledge that every hour would have its own weight and no amount of coffee would ever take the place of lost sleep. Yet, I still needed more coffee, immediately. There was an all-night stall near the market, serving mostly black cab drivers and meat porters. And I got in line while men with shaved heads and fierce faces fussed over the chestnut-coloured dog at my daughter's feet. Stan leapt like a salmon, overcome with excitement, and they laughed. All the hard men of the London night. And I was happy then, knowing that our dog had yet to learn fear. As we neared the school gates, Scout fell into step with another little girl. The girl's mother turned away to talk to another mother, and I waited at the gates with Stan and soothed him as he whimpered to see Scout leave. We waited in case she turned round to wave, but she was with her friend now, and she had forgotten all about us. Before she disappeared into her own world, I reflected that her school uniform was too big, and it would be too big for a long time. Mrs. Murphy was right. There was almost nothing of my daughter. There was almost nothing of her, and she was my everything. Hugo Buck's home was in a ported apartment overlooking Regent's Park. The porter must have been on his tea break when I got there because the double glass doors were locked. I stood outside, leaning on the bell, and watching the dogs in the park. They were all off lead. Big, good-looking dogs, Labradors and Retrievers and Airedales and some small fry, Beagles and Westies, all of them panting and confident as they sniffed piles of leaves and each other, coming back when their owner called. I could not imagine a time when Stan would come when I called. Detective? A young woman and man in their 20s were walking towards me. I had clocked the pair of them when I was parking, taking them for a couple of local rich kids, a pair of good-looking scruffs, carefully unkempt, passing a single cigarette between them as they sat on a low wall by the manicured gardens. Only the children of the wealthy can afford to be that laid back at that age. On the driveway, there was a chauffeur lounging in a big black Merc, squeezed in tight between a couple of Porsche 911s, and he eyed up the girl as he played with his peaked cap. I saw now the young guy had a camera slung around his neck. Press, then, I thought. It was a girl who did the talking. You're here to speak to Mrs. Buck. Is she a suspect? Do you expect to make an arrest soon? I pressed my thumb on the buzzer and left it there. Is this a hate crime, detective? I looked at her. Every murder is a hate crime, I said. Who did you say you write for?
I didn't, she said.
She dug a card out of her bag, and when she gave it to me, I saw that there was a tiny digital voice recorder in her other hand. A red light was shining. Scarlet Bush, I read, the Daily Post, then her mobile phone number, email address, and 4 or 5 social network accounts. That seemed like a lot to me.
Scarlet Bush, she laughed. Sounds like a porn star, right?
When I looked up, she nodded at the photographer, and almost lazily, he swung his camera towards me and pulled the trigger. It took photographs like a machine gun. Hey, I said, raising a hand to protect myself.
Have you seen what the online community are saying?
The little voice recorder was in my face.
They're calling Bob the Butcher a hero.
I stared at her. Bob the Butcher?
He's all over the social networks. He's been trending for 24 hours.
Scarlet Bush had a disbelieving little smile on her face.
You genuinely weren't aware of that.
The porter was finally opening the door. I pressed my warrant card against the glass and said my name and rank, so she knew my name too.
And how does that feel for you, DC Wolf? She asked, when the social networks are calling the murderer a hero and the victim a scumbag.
Sorry, the porter said, finally opening up. I paused in the open doorway. Murderers are never heroes, I said. Scarlet Bush smiled at me more broadly now, as if we both knew that wasn't quite true. Mrs. Natasha Buck, widow of the dead banker, was in dark glasses and wet from the shower, tall, early 30s, still in her bathrobe. The strange combination of robe and shades made her look as though she was on holiday heading for the pool. Her damp hair was blonde, very blonde, the white gold you see on black and white film stars. She looked like a natural blonde, but maybe not that natural. She had the worked-on thinness that you see with a lot of wealthy women, and the same sense of entitlement. Toweling her long blonde hair, she frowned at my warrant card as if it was junk mail from Pepe's Pizza Parlour. I'm very sorry for your loss, Mrs. Buck. I know this must be a very distressing time.
I already told the police what I know, she said. A young black man and an older white woman. She had the carefully clipped enunciation of a foreigner who has spent 10 years around serious English money. D.I. Gain and D.I. Whitestone, I said, I know. They even swabbed my mouth. They do that for your DNA, to rule you out. We just need to double-check some details, if that's convenient. Not really. She glanced at her watch, shining like a diamond-encrusted bauble on her thin wrist. Actually, I'm about to go out. She was strikingly attractive, with the kind of face that you would not look away from until you found yourself staring, and perhaps not even then. But it felt like a lot of men had told her she was beautiful. We do have an appointment, Mrs. Buck. If it's inconvenient now, we could do it at some later date. A pause. At the station? She looked at me properly for the first time, then she laughed. The more money they have, I thought, the less they fear the police. Should I call my lawyer? She said. We're just talking, Mrs. Buck. Her hair fell across her face. She looked at me through the damp veil as she lazily pulled it back. Am I a suspect? Her voice had become lower and slower. I liked it more. Not yet, I said. We stared at each other.
Oh, let's get it over with, she said. Coffee?
I'll have to make it myself. I had to let our housekeeper go when I found her with my late husband's penis in her mouth. She stood up with a sigh. It's so hard to get good help. It was a lovely apartment. Clean, expensive, uncluttered. Big budget, good taste, no children. I thought of the office with all the blood and tried to feel her husband's presence in this place. But if his spirit was near, I couldn't sense him. It felt like the home of a woman who had been living alone for a long time. There were two paintings on the wall, clearly by the same artist. City scenes with a kind of Sunday morning stillness about them. One was of deserted railway lines, the other some kind of tunnel, and they were both misty and dreamlike, bathed in the soft light of dawn or twilight. There were no people in them, and that gave them a strange kind of peace. I felt like I almost recognised these places. I leaned in close to the painting of the tunnel, looking for the artist's name, but there were just two lowercase initials, J.S. A miniature dog came into the room while Mrs. Buck was making the coffee. Looked like a Pekingese Chihuahua cross. I let her sniff my hand and then picked her up and placed her on my thigh. She stood there, shivering, as weightless as an insect. When I tried to stroke her, she ambled off to the far end of the sofa and stared at me defiantly as she emptied her bladder. Mrs. Buck came back into the room with a cafetiere on a silver tray.
"Susan, you bad girl," she said. "You know you're meant to do that on the carpet."
Mrs. Buck dropped a silk cushion over the stain, pushed the dog onto the floor and then sat opposite me, leaning back, crossing her long legs and sighing as her robe slid open. She pulled it shut as an iPhone on a coffee table between us began to vibrate. The dog barked at it, quaking with rage as Mrs. Buck picked it up and began reading a message. She made me feel like I wasn't there at all. I cleared my throat. "Who would want to kill your husband?" I said. Her pretty face was frowning at the iPhone. "Apart from you," I added. Now she looked at me. "Mrs. Buck," I said, "please try to concentrate on me for the next little while." She took a final look at her phone and turned it off, her face tight with anger.
"Do you really think I wanted my husband dead?" she said. "You stupid little man."
I took a breath. Officers were called to this address 3 days before he died.
"That? A lover's tiff?"
"You made threats on your husband's life."
"What do you expect me to say when I find the help blowing him? You say all sorts of things in the heat of the moment."
"You FedExed your bed to his office."
"I wanted to embarrass him. I wanted to humiliate him. I wanted him to know what it feels like."
"And then someone cut his throat." She exhaled as she poured out coffee.
"I can see it looks bad. Sugar? Milk?"
"Black, please."
"I didn't want him to die. I just wanted him to stop. To stop... what's the nice way of saying it? Sleeping around."
It was good coffee.
"Did your husband have many friends?" You know what the English are like, or at least that kind of upper-class Englishman. Hugo came from a family where they let their dogs get in their beds and send their children to kennels. He was shipped off to boarding school at the age of 7, made friends there and kept them forever. He didn't have much use for the rest of the world, including his wife. I thought about the photograph on his desk. Where did he go to school? Trinity College, Cambridge. Prince Charles went there. She was smiling with wistful pride. Before that, I said. Potter's Field, she said. His father went there and his grandfather. Hugo called it the Eton for athletes, musicians and thugs. He meant it as a compliment. Which one was he? An athlete. My husband was good at games, detective. Did he enjoy his years at Potter's Field? Sadistic masters, stodgy food, cold showers. That constant obsession with sport, casual bullying, a lot of homosexual sex. He always said they were the best days of his life. Did your husband have lovers? She snorted. Apart from your housekeeper, I said. Plenty. And did the lovers have husbands? Some of them. You think a jealous husband might have killed him? Possible, I suppose. But Hugo was fond of the help. He stayed away from my friends, I'll give him that. Although, I don't think he did it out of any sense of morality. He just preferred his entertainment below stairs. I'll need the name and contact details of the housekeeper. You told my colleagues you didn't have them. The anger flared. Because the bitch caught a plane back to Kiev. I told them. Do I have to say everything twice? Did he fall out with any business partners? Did he receive any threatening phone calls, emails, letters? She shook her head. She had had enough. She took out her phone. Where were you between the hours of 5 and 7 a.m. yesterday? I'm going to need your credit card records, mobile phone bills, computers and their passwords. Laptops, desktops, tablets, the lot. Are you listening to me, Mrs. Buck? She stood up. Do you really want to know about my husband? We stared at each other. Yes. Then let me tell you about my husband, she said. With a shrug, she let the robe fall from her shoulders and to the floor. I saw the bruises on her arms and legs. On her long limbs, there were fresh, livid marks, and there were old and fading marks. All the signs of systematic and regular beatings that carefully avoided the face. This was my husband. Mrs. Buck. He was the violent one, not me. When I picked up that little oyster knife, he laughed in my face. He laughed at me, detective. But I didn't want him dead, no matter what I told him. The tears finally came and they seemed real enough to me. I wanted him to be kind, she continued. I wanted him to stop running around. I wanted him to stop humiliating me with women too poor and too stupid to tell him no. I wanted him to stop. I was on my feet. Please, Mrs. Buck. Natasha. I picked up her robe and draped it around her shoulders. She put her arms around my waist. I think she just wanted to be held for a while. I think she was sick of all the questions. I think she was just lonely. Our faces were next to each other. I could feel her breath, and I felt the blood flood into me unbidden. 'Cause I was lonely too. After a long moment, I pulled myself away, cracking my shin against the coffee table and waking up the dog. Natasha Buck smiled sadly as she slipped the robe back on and tied the belt around her slim waist. Ah, that rare breed, she said, nodding towards my left hand. My wedding ring had caught the soft light as I picked up my cup. A married man who loves his wife. Drink your coffee, I said.